This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. As many of you may know, the KSFR family lost a dear friend earlier this month. Charles Maynard was a doctor, a newsman, an actor and playwright, an author, a musician, and a wonderful friend to many. We're going to hear today two interviews from the Radio Cafe archives. The first is from 2013, when he released his book, Thriving Through Devastating Illness. You have written this from, as you put it in your own words, both sides of the stethoscope. You are both a doctor and a patient. What prompted you to write this book?
It was that experience of going through severe illnesses and being a physician and realizing how difficult it is to work through the system and deal with families and things when you have a serious illness. So I saw a lot of books on battling cancer or surviving this disease or that disease. I didn't want to battle or survive. I just wanted to go on with life.
Right.
And that was the secret.
And so that was a really interesting theme, because whereas other people used war metaphors, you not only just went on with your life and got treatment and talked about both getting treatment and denial, which is part of the process, but you also describe other people's journeys. One of the things that really struck me was two people with pancreatic cancer. One of them got every treatment in the book and died. One of them said, you know, I'm not going to get treated, and years later he was thriving.
Yeah.
How do you explain that?
It was amazing. It was two women, and they actually came in the same week to the office, and both wound up with the same diagnosis. One said, I want to know everything about it, and I want to do everything that can be done and whatever it takes. And the other one said, you know what? I've had a nice life. I'm just going to keep living. And the first one lasted a few months, and the second woman was still alive years later when I left that town.
Amazing.
I think the attitude is what makes all the difference, and we know it stimulates your immune system.
Right, and it's very tricky business, because there's a lot of stuff about that, about attitude and spirituality and things like that, which really don't have a place inside the medical paradigm.
No, and they should. It tries to creep in, but it really doesn't exist, particularly in today's hospitals, which I'm not terribly fond of.
Charles, you, when you were working in this small town, and you're a native New Mexican.
I am born and raised in Albuquerque.
And so you were in New Mexico serving your country, serving the people in a rural area, and there was no x-ray machine.
No, and it was a big problem, because down there, the closest hospital was, well, the closest one you could get to was about 70 miles away. There was one about 40 miles away that was a better hospital, but it was over a mountain road that was closed most of the winter. And if a patient came in to me and say they had a possible broken arm or pneumonia, I had to bundle them up, put them in the car, send them on a car trip for an hour, which you know what you feel like when you're sick. You don't want to go for a long car ride.
Right.
Wait at the hospital for an hour, get the x-ray, come back for another hour to see me, and then see me in my office and we could deal with it. And that was just untenable. But I found out there was, next to the clinic I was in, was an old abandoned hospital from the 50s. And I learned it had an x-ray machine in it. And the county manager said, hey, if it works, you can use it. We'll pay the electricity. And I had thought about this possibility. And the last year of training, I used to spend the nights I was on call that were quiet in x-ray learning how to take my own films. So I got into the hospital, found the machine, turned it on. And lo and behold, it worked. And for 3 years, every day I was in there for several hours taking and developing x-rays.
And it was the old style of x-ray where you take a picture and you develop the film in chemicals and all that.
In a dip tank that you have to hold it for a certain amount of time, and that varied with the temperature, and it was an ancient art. But the problem was I never had the machine checked or calibrated, and it turns out the entire time it was leaking radiation. So for 3 years I was radiating myself without knowing it.
And the result of that was not a happy result.
No, it knocked out my immune system, which was the end of practicing medicine. It's led to the cancers that I've dealt with, probably contributed to the stroke, which was severe. So it has not been a lot of fun.
So you then became suddenly a patient after having been a robust young man who never really thought about your own mortality, even as you were dealing with everybody else's.
Oh, that's so true. You feel bulletproof. But all of a sudden, I was in a rather unique position at a unique time in our history, because, as you know, our medical system is rapidly undergoing change, not necessarily for the better. And I kind of had a front row seat for it as a patient, and I had started to see the change as a physician. So I was able to witness what's happened from both sides.
And you suddenly had to deal with the fact that you had a devastating illness, and you did. I mean, it's such an interesting book to me. We're talking about Charles Maynard's book, Thriving Through Devastating Illness, because all the things that you might have counseled patients against, or some of the things, you were doing yourself, like just kind of going into denial.
Absolutely. Doctors are the worst patients. It's no secret.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. We think we know it all, and you can't tell us anything, and we can't make mistakes. So we get in trouble all the time.
So how did that play out for you?
I had to get through that, and I had to say, I am not the physician here. I am the patient. And what's worked for me is I actually will tell my doctors, you handle this. If there's anything I need to decide or worry about, you tell me. Otherwise, I'm leaving you to deal with it. And I do what they say, but then I go on with working at the radio and doing the other activities that I love.
Now, you did find yourself in the position of having to stop practicing medicine.
Yes, I did. And I will tell you the truth. At the time, medicine had become absolutely no fun. Everybody was mad at everybody all the time. The receptionist was mad at the patient because the patient was yelling at them. The patient was mad because they couldn't get an appointment. The doctors were mad because they were being asked to see too many patients at a time. The nurses were in tears because it was all falling on them. And quitting was almost a relief. And I have not met a doctor yet who asked what happened to me. And I said I retired, that didn't say I'd give anything to get out of it.
It's a book for doctors, patients, and family members. And as you say, when somebody gets sick, it's not just the person who's sick. It's their entire family and often friends who are really affected by it.
You know, it's like any other major event in our life. It doesn't ever just affect us. We have our family and those close around us. And an illness is, of course, particularly a major illness, is it impacts the entire family, from the kids, the dog, on up. And it's really important to pay attention to them and make sure that they're getting the care that they need during this time, and that you have good open communication with them.
What in particular should people be aware of when a family member is sick in terms of young children? What do they need?
You know, that's a very tough question, because some children are a little smarter, a little farther down the road, and they want to know what's going on. Some children aren't going to understand it, so you really have to play it close by ear. Older children, however, you don't assume they don't know what's going on, because they do. and they need to know what's going on, and you don't have to scare them, but tell them the truth.
What do you mean by older?
Oh, 8, 9, 10 years old. They're very, I mean, everyone in the household is aware something's wrong, but the kids that are a little older understand something major is going on here.
Yeah.
And the family I grew up in had the rule you don't talk about it. And so we never knew when somebody in the family was sick or having money trouble or anything else, but that's not healthy.
It's interesting, too, because I think a lot of the time even when there's not an illness, but parents are having conflict and they're kind of fighting behind closed doors quietly and the children don't actually hear it, they still know something is going on. And it makes them kind of crazy if they don't get told there's a little problem in the house and we're trying to deal with it or whatever, as opposed to everything's fine, dear. Because they know that's not true, and it just turns into some kind of cognitive dissonance that when they're adults, they spend thousands in therapy trying to deal with.
Absolutely. It's better to say, we're having a little problem, but everything's going to be okay. So they understand that this is not an end deal.
So you were diagnosed with thyroid cancer, and this is your story about that was another interesting story about the medical system today, which is that three different doctors told you three entirely different things about what you had, how extensive it was, and how serious it was.
It was very confusing because my primary doctor said, you have thyroid cancer, there's no question. One endocrinologist says, I don't know, you came in too early, I can't tell. Another doctor, the cancer doctor, said, no, you don't have it. Finally, the surgeon said, I believe your primary, let's take it out. And they took it out and sent it to the lab, and the lab couldn't figure out. They knew something was wrong, so they sent it to a second hospital that came up with the diagnosis. But we then sent it to MD Anderson. They came up with a third diagnosis on the same tissue.
And you're going bananas because you think, where's the science here?
Well, studying medicine, you learn that it is a whole lot more art than science. We would like it to be more science, but the truth is, it'll always be an art.
What do you mean by that? Let's talk about medicine as an art.
Well, relying on cold facts and numbers and dosages and stimulus response just doesn't work. I used to try with every patient that I'd see to decide what kind of doctor that patient wanted. Some want the old-fashioned family doc. Some want the new hotshot university guy. Some want the laid-back guy. And I tried to play that kind of doctor so that they felt more comfortable communicating with me, because really, all the tests in the world are great and all the scans and all the diagnostic work we do, but we really learn what's wrong with somebody when you sit down face to face and talk to them.
Which I think is a very, very important thing in an era where we're talking about doing medicine via iPad.
Yeah, and it's getting controversial for that very reason. I'll never forget my grandmother, shortly before she died, was in her 80s. Very outspoken, living in a nursing home, and the doctor made us bring her to his office for a visit. So we took her there, and he did as usual, walked in the room, did a cursory exam, started to leave, and my grandmother slapped her cane on the door and said, you take a chair and sit down. You can leave when I'm finished asking you what I need to know. And that's really, that should never have to happen. We should automatically do that.
Very interesting. Now, you have had cases where there's one case in particular of an old woman who was one of your patients, and one day you saw her and she had dressed herself to the nines.
We had in this little town, it was technically a nursing home, but they had several levels, and one of them was like assisted living apartments, and that's where she lived. And I used to check everybody every month, and they'd bring them into the exam room I had there on the facility, and I'd talk to them, examine them. Well, one day she's totally dressed up. She's got on a new dress, a hat, a big smile, and I said, "What's going on?" And she said, "Oh, you never see me again." And I said, "Well, what do you mean I'll never see you again?" And she said, "Oh, I've decided to die." Well, I dove right into the chart looking to see what I'd miss on the test, or did I order the wrong medicine, or
did she say something. Decided?
Yes, she said, "I decided to die." And
but not to take pills.
Right.
Just to sort of...
Yeah, she said, "I've had a nice life. I miss my husband, and it's just time for me to go." Well, I thought she was nuts. Of course, I'm a young doctor. I haven't learned much yet. And about 4 days later, they call me at night from the nursing home to say she'd passed on. And I went to the nursing home to pronounce her, and she was laying there in the bed with the most gorgeous smile I've ever seen.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it was an incredible lesson.
What was the lesson for you?
Well, I think we have more control over our destiny than we admit. I've had situations where other doctors or myself have whispered to a patient it's okay to let go. And it's amazing how often shortly after that they'll let go and they'll die. And I think we have the ability to do that if we want to.
We're talking to Charles Maynard about his book, Thriving Through Devastating Illness. You have a chapter in this book about your own spirituality, and it's interesting because I think there are more than you would think. There's a lot of scientific and medical people, doctors and researchers and so on, who have a very strong and active spiritual life, even though it's a completely different paradigm than what they practice as doctors.
Which, it's too bad it is a completely different paradigm. I know for me, the more I learned about the human body and how it works, and the more detail I got into, the more you realize this isn't an accident. This is an incredible feat of engineering. If you just look, just the operation of a cell is so fascinating and so intelligent and beyond anything I could ever think of to put together. And I think that happens to a lot of us. The more we study and learn, the more we say, wait a minute, there's more. And then you learn it in practice with things like the woman I told you about that said I decided to die. You get daily lessons in it if you keep your eyes open.
So what is your own spiritual practice?
Well, I am a Methodist. I've been a Presbyterian in the past, but I keep a very firm grasp on the fact that I think religion is a man-made construct, and we have to realize that, and it's as such, it's imperfect, and it always will be. The God or the leader of the universe or her, whatever you want to call her, is a spiritual reality, but that is separate from religion. And I think people keep those, I don't know, for me it works to realize that my religion is not the same thing.
So how did your spiritual practice, your religion, your Methodism?
Yes.
Help you, if it did, during cancer and stroke and spinal surgeries and knee surgeries? I don't know how you're sitting before us, Charles. I mean, you have survived so much. It's just unbelievable.
I'll just as an example give the stroke. I woke up one morning and could only speak gibberish and could barely walk. And had a major stroke, wiped out a quarter of my brain, basically, and was not doing well. They didn't think I was going to survive out of the emergency room. But
I mean, people were saying, "Oh, you know, have your wife call your friends."
Yeah,
if they ever want to see you again.
That's right. This is going to be the last chance. And at one point, they decided to do a spinal tap, and you know, those ER rooms are small. Well, it was packed with doctors and technicians and students who had never seen it before, and the regular nursing traffic in and out. It was loud. All the lights were on. I couldn't tell, you know, what time of day it was, and I felt like I was in the way and everybody else needed to be there. And all of a sudden I heard this voice that said, just close your eyes for 3 seconds, Chuck, and then open it. And I don't know where it came from, but I did it, and I opened them, and I was in 14 hours later in a quiet, dark room, my wife sitting at the door keeping an eye on me, and I had made it through the ER, so.
And got into a coma.
Yes, I had sure enough, which, of course, scared people even more, but I was only out of work for 2 weeks. I was back on the air. I wasn't great, but I was back on the air.
Which is unbelievable because, I mean, you described this, and I guess you had to ask, I mean, some of this must have come from asking other people because it's hard for you to remember this. I mean, people would say, what's your name? And you'd say, Fishtail Coffee Cup Sidewalk.
Right. It was just gibberish would come out, and I'd know it wasn't what I was trying to say. But the funny thing was, I never was scared. Even though I make my living through the radio, and this is how I spend my time, and it's my love, I was never scared through all that. And I can blame it on my brain being swollen, or I can blame it on the fact that I felt I was being cared for by a force that was not ready to take me yet.
Very interesting. And that was what you kind of intuitively felt, like my time here is not over?
Yes. And I talked to another woman who had a much worse stroke than I did, who went through the same thing. And she suddenly had the feeling, she said, that it was not time. She thought it was time to go over, but she got the overwhelming feeling it's not. And she's still with us today.
The whole idea of fear, the whole experience of fear, is something that I think is beyond our control. I mean, you didn't say, Chuck, don't be scared. You just weren't. And then some people just are.
Right. And I don't know about you, but one thing I can't do is tell myself not to be afraid, because if I'm afraid, I'm afraid.
No kidding.
And the best thing to do isn't to pretend like you're not. It's to admit it to yourself and then still do what you need to do.
You have gone through all of this, and it really hasn't abated. I mean, you have had one challenge after another. Did you at some point experience fear, Charles?
Oh, sure. Several times throughout illnesses, when I had bone marrow failure and was looking into transplant, and I was terrified. I've been scared before of potential diagnoses, but the secret is I just let myself be scared, because there'd be something wrong with me if I wasn't.
Yeah. It is kind of, again, this book is almost, I mean, it is amusing at times, where you say, it wasn't cancer, it wasn't, you know, all these other things, it was actually the stroke that led you to think that maybe, just maybe, you weren't immortal.
That was, and embarrassingly, that's the first time it ever occurred to me that I wasn't going to live forever. And that's because I'm an eternal adolescent. I understand that.
Ah, yes. The arrested development syndrome.
Absolutely. And I love it. Keeps me enjoying life.
What do you think have been your biggest lessons that you wanted to impart to others through this book?
I think the biggest one, quite simply, is these things are going to happen. You know, the reality is that unless we get hit by a bus, we're probably going to wind up at some point, certainly with ourselves or a significant other, dealing with the devastating illness. And you have the choice between making that illness the center of your life or what fulfills you the center of your life. And as long as you check the one that fulfills you, the other you'll be able to take care of. You'll intuitively know what to do. You'll get through it. It'll end up however it's supposed to end up, and you'll be okay with it.
That was Charles Maynard on his book Thriving Through Devastating Illness from the Radio Cafe Archives. It's part of our memorial to our friend Charles. The interview we're about to hear is from September of last year. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Charles Maynard. He's author of the new book Adventures of a Small Town Doctor. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. How are you?
I am very happy because I read this book last night and I laughed out loud. It was so funny and it was so interesting about your work when you graduated from med school. The deal, I love how you start the book. You say you always wanted to go to med school, and then when you got in, you'd realize that you'd never thought about how to pay for it. So
never,
what did you do?
Never occurred to me until I got the letter from the, and I was going private, not public school, with what was required for the tuition. And right then I realized I had forgotten to plan for that. Luckily, the government had a program, well, they still do, called the National Health Service Corps, where doctors are given full rides through medical school, full scholarship, and a living stipend in exchange for going to an underserved area and practicing 1 year for every year they supported you.
And so how many years did that end up being that you worked in this small town?
Little more than three.
Okay.
Almost four, yeah.
And so you went to medical school, and then you got sent to a small town that we'll call Benton.
Correct.
Not its real name.
Not its real name.
Here in New Mexico.
Correct.
Now, you were already a New Mexican?
Yes, I'm born and raised in Albuquerque. I actually joined the program hoping to come to Santa Fe because La Familia is a National Health Service Corps provider site. So that was always my plan, to wind up here. I wound up someplace a little different.
It reminds me a little bit of a TV show that was on in the early 90s called Northern Exposure.
That was about the same program.
Yeah.
If you watch the pilot, yeah, he was on the exact same program, but he got to go to Alaska.
Yeah, and he was a super New York dude,
right.
Very urban dude, and thinks he's going to be in Anchorage and ends up in this tiny town. And I have to say that in some ways, the chapters of your book reminded me, not so much of that, but kind of like a 1950s sitcom where bad things happen, but it all came out okay because of the good doctor.
Well, they all came out okay. I don't know how
Except
much it was because of the good doctor, but it was an experience. You finish your residency training, and then you get sent, and you're still wet behind the ears, no practical experience, and all of a sudden, at least in my case, I was the only doctor in the whole county. No hospital, no backup, no nothing.
And really, I mean, you were being asked to do things that you weren't even trained for, like delivering not only babies, but calves.
Taking care of dogs that have been shot by their nearsighted hunting owners. The assumption in a small town is if your name is doctor, you know how to do everything a doctor can do. And of course, that's not true, but you get an experience. And I couldn't have picked a better learning experience. I'd never do it again, but it was an education.
Well, it's the kind of education where you really have the opportunity to practice, I mean, the widest possible range of medicine, because there's probably cases coming into a clinic like that that you wouldn't see in a regular city.
Oh, no, we could see a kid with an earache 1 minute and then major trauma off the interstate the next and have to take care of both of them with an equal amount of competence.
One of the things, speaking of earaches, is that you encountered some folk remedies, and some of them were not necessarily so helpful.
No, but the one you're reminded of was very interesting to me. When I started practicing there, I was seeing kids, 3 and 4, with earaches, and they had burns around their ears on the outside, and I had decided that it was a sign of child abuse. And then when I saw 4 or 5 different kids with it, I thought, there must be a cult operating here. I found out what it actually was an old-fashioned treatment for ear infection where grandmothers, abuelas, would roll up a cone of newspaper, shove it in a kid's ear, and set it on fire. The idea being, if there was an infection inside, it would pull it to the outside. Now, that's anatomically impossible, but the problem with it was the grandmothers would get distracted with the phone or television and not pull the cone out, and it would burn the child's head.
Oh, my goodness.
Yep.
What, I mean, when you are in that position as the small town doctor, and you're respected, but you're also new in town, you're an outsider, what is your role like? Can you say to the grandmothers, please don't burn your children's ears anymore?
No. No, you had the, and you hit on something that I didn't really talk about much, but I was an outsider. Anybody that wasn't born in Benton was an outsider. And so you're constantly battling with that and acceptance, and on top of trying to be all things to all people, you're trying to go along with local custom.
Right, right. And so you arrived in Benton. You were a young doctor. This was your first opportunity to really practice medicine. You were promised one set of things. You got there. It didn't quite look like...
No. The house was supposed to be a small farm, and it was a small shack. And the clinic, which was supposed to be a new modern clinic, was actually an old portable classroom that had sort of been refigured for the clinic. Once I got there, we reconfigured it again and had an emergency room and made the best use out of it.
Now, one of the things about small towns, and I guess you have this everywhere, but when you're in a small town, everybody knows it, is that you've got the town characters. And some of those characters are on the... you know, in law enforcement, some of them are like the town drunk. And then there's Crazy Freddy.
Crazy Freddy. I have to remember which one was Crazy Freddy. Yes. Freddy was a highway patrolman in Benton. He was with we know we're in New Mexico. He was with the New Mexico State Police. And he had been stationed in northern New Mexico in a fairly plum assignment. And one day his supervisor told him if he could go ahead and arrest five people they had warrants for, he could have the rest of the day off. So Freddie thought it through, went home, got his regular car, left his police car at home, went to the first house where there was one of the fugitives, knocked on the door. When the guy opened the door, Freddie hit him with the bat, knocked him out, carried him, and put him in the back seat of his car. Then he drove to the second person's house, did the exact same thing. 3 hours later, he came back to the station with five unconscious people in the back seat of his car and turned them in, and that's how he wound up permanently exiled to Benton. He was given a vacation without pay and sent down to where we were. First time I met him was at a wreck in the middle of the night on a mountain road. And I looked in the back of his police car and there was a deer. And he claimed that he had found it on the road. But he was known for hunting, whether it was in season or not.
So he'd just gone out with his police arms and...
Right.
Shot a
deer right before the wreck. You could tell right before he went. But it worked out well because he was in the neighborhood where the wreck was. Otherwise, he might have been an hour away. So his hunting helped.
And there's quite a bit about law enforcement in this book. There always have been, but here there in small Benton, New Mexico, some really aggressive, crazy cops.
There were, and it was because it was on the interstate, they were pretty busy. And I took care of the jail, and I took care of the police, and I went to the scenes, and I was also the photographer because I was the only one in town that had a camera, 35mm. But my first experience, they called me to the jail. Somebody was having a heart attack, and they let me in the back, and it was in a big population cell with about 30 people. And I ran back where the guy was on the bunk. And I noticed that the two officers were laughing at me. And I took care of the patient, got him out, and I asked them afterwards why they were laughing. They said nobody had ever been stupid enough just to run into the population cell before.
Well, it sounds like the population in the local jail was not exactly the toughest group of people ever. I mean, they would let him out to play softball games.
Oh, absolutely. Or they'd let him out to wash my car. My office was across the street from the jail, and there'd be a knock at the back door, and it would be somebody in an orange jumpsuit asking for my car keys and tell me the sheriff had sent him over to wash the car. One time, that got a little embarrassing, because after he washed the car, there's another knock at the door, and because of a long story, I wound up carrying a gun with me at night, and I left it in the car. And the guy in the orange jumpsuit was at the back door with my gun in his hand, and he handed it to me and said, "Doc, you got to be careful where you leave these. You never know who will get their hands on them."
Why were you issued a gun?
I was issued a gun because I had no problem seeing people at night that I didn't know that were coming from off the interstate. I'd see them by myself in the office, and one night wound up seeing somebody that had just killed a doctor in another state. And from that point on, the sheriff was insistent that if I was going to see patients at night, I had to carry a gun. I often wonder what some of the people that saw me after that thought, because he said I had to wear it on a hip and he'd come check. People from out of town coming through with a medical emergency and a doctor came in with a six shooter on his hip, they must have thought they were in the real old West.
I mean, it's crazy. You have a weapon and you're a healer at the same time.
Yeah, I was always afraid of having to shoot somebody and explain that.
It's interesting, though, because in that particular case where the guy came off the interstate and was threatening, that's part of a problem that is still ongoing, which is prescription pill addiction.
A major problem now. I was adamant when I was a younger doctor, particularly, about not prescribing controlled substances. And one reason was, in the middle of nowhere, I didn't want to get a reputation, have a lot of people dropping by. I didn't want dropping by. So tended not to use them too much.
Now, you did use a drug that you actually invented called Cibaquil.
True.
Tell us about Cibaquil.
True. One of the best drugs ever known to man. It's a plain capsule with powdered sugar in it. I didn't like to prescribe tranquilizers, and there were a number of patients coming to me for them. This was a time when Valium came out. It was on the cover of Time and Life, and everybody thought that they needed to have tranquilizers, and I just always felt, still do, that it might be better to talk through a problem rather than throw a drug at it. So the pharmacist one day said, "Why don't you give them a placebo?" And he told me several months later he was kidding, but I thought it was a great idea. So we made these Cibaquil caps that had nothing in them and gave them to patients with a story about how strong it was and how they couldn't take it with other medicine or drink, and they had to call me before they took an aspirin, and it worked like a charm. At one point, I had most of the county on it, and the whole place just changed.
And it was complete. It was powdered sugar.
Powdered sugar.
There was, and it's so funny, the power of placebo was such that somebody took a whole bottle and ended up in the emergency room overdosed.
In a coma, yes.
What is that?
That's what I said. I love the placebo response. I'm a placebo responder. You can tell me there's nothing in it, it'll still work. So I don't know how much of modern medicine is still placebo. I have a suspicion it's a lot more than we want to admit.
I had a friend who, he wasn't a doctor or anything, but he worked in the jail in Kodiak, Alaska.
Oh, my.
And he was 6'9", and he was very gentle. And that made him a really great jailer, because nobody would mess with him because he was so tall, but they liked him because he was so gentle. But there were a lot of people there with really bad problems, and he... And the, I guess, whoever the medical person was on staff, invented this thing called Obacalp, which was a capsule. That's, of course, placebo spelled backwards.
Right.
And it worked and people would, you know, beg for it. They would say, "Please, Doc, give me some more of that Obacalp."
Oh, and they loved the Cibaquil. And we were aware of Obacalp. That's been around a while. And so we wanted something different. So we came up with Cebaquil, different color. And I don't know if the Obi-Kelp had the powdered sugar or just flour in it. There's no telling.
Yeah, there's no telling. But you even came up with the half dose of the Cebaquil and then the time release.
Oh, we had to, because the first group of patients that came back said it worked great for their nerves, but it was too strong. They couldn't get off the couch. They couldn't get to work. So that's when we came up with the half strength. And they liked that. That was a good drug, but they had to take it every 4 hours. So we came up with the time release. So
which was like just little, sugar
little candy
pellets.
Pills. Yeah, just like a contact. We took the little colored candies and threw in one side, and the powdered sugar in another. I was going to get rich making those because there's no downside, there's no side effects, and it was cheap to make. But after the lady overdosed on them, I decided against it.
We're talking to Charles Maynard about his book, Adventures of a Small Town Doctor. So you did this for several years, and you dealt with all kinds of people there. You made some friends, and you, like, what was your status in the community by the time you left?
Boy, that's a good question. Much more accepted, of course. Not by then, I knew everybody, because in a small town you meet everybody, and I wound up taking care of most of them, so it was a little deeper relationship than just somebody you meet in the grocery store. I have never been back. It's been 30 plus years, and I have not been back.
Oh my goodness.
To Benton.
Are you going to present the book there?
I think so. Yeah, I'm hoping to.
I would imagine that if so many of the people who you met were born and raised there, their children will still be there.
They should be. I figured out the last patient I delivered who was in the office one Friday morning has got to be in her 30s by now. So they're getting older. And most of the people that are mentioned in the book, the sheriff and the mayor, those people are long, long gone.
You, of course, as a doctor, had to deal with what pretty much every doctor has to deal with, and that is losing patients. And the very first chapter of the book is completely hilarious, because the first patient you lost, basically, what was it, somebody called you and...
She was dead before I ever had my medical license. They didn't move real fast on anything in Benton, and this woman had been sick actually since before Friday, which was the day I got my license, and I was called to see her Monday morning, and she was very dead.
And they said, can you go check on Granny and try to figure out what's wrong with her? She's hard of hearing.
Right, and I figured out right away when I saw her what was wrong with her. I had that good medical training. I figured it out. She was dead, and I don't mean let's maybe start CPR dead. She was... They should have called me a week ago dead.
Oh, yeah. My goodness.
Yeah.
But then there were other ones that were very painful, like a 12-year-old girl who succumbed for reasons that nobody could ever figure out.
And that case still stays with me. She was perfectly healthy. I had taken care of her the whole time I was there, and she just something wasn't right on Saturday, according to her mom, and by Monday she was in a university hospital and did not survive, and we never did know what she died from.
When you have cases like that, what do you do with them emotionally? I mean, do you fret about, I wish I could have saved her? She was in that case, I guess she was in somebody else's hands.
Right, but even so, of course, you look back, did you do everything right? And in that case, I did, because I sent her straight to a hospital because I knew something was bad wrong. But you have to, in a sense, let it go. You have to say, could I have done anything different? And most of the time, you would have done things just the same with the same amount of information. You have to forgive yourself and move on.
Now, you, several years ago, and I think we had you on the air at that time, did a performance based on this material. You kind of wrote a one-man show and performed it. What are your hopes and plans with the book and with these stories?
I've actually, And what you saw, what I did here was about 50% invented and 50% adapted from the truth. I have for the last 15 years been going to medical conventions and doing these stories as an after dinner speaker or an after lunch speaker. And what we would like to do with it is to mainstream it to more mainstream audience besides just medical, because the stories play. They work well. And I love to stand up and talk to people. And when you can talk about yourself, hey, doesn't get any better than that.
Well, do you find that a lot of other doctors can relate? Or is it pretty unusual to end up in a small town situation like this?
This is a unique situation, except for people that were in that program. And the only ones I ever met were in the Indian Health Service, which offered the same scholarship, that had similar experiences that were that crazy. Because most doctors today go into a specialty, they train in a hospital for a long time, they practice in larger cities. There's not a lot of opportunity out there to survive financially and go in the middle of nowhere and be the only doctor.
I'm surprised more people don't do it.
You know, let me tell you the other side of it, though. While I was there, I saw an average of 45 patients a day. The record was 73 during a flu epidemic. I did not sleep through an entire night the years that I was there. I was called on the phone, and most of those nights had to actually go out and do something. It was exhausting, and I could not have kept up the pace. And I see doctors that have been in small towns all their life, and I don't know how they do it.
That's crazy, because at a certain point you would think it would impinge on the competence of the doctor, him or herself.
Oh, the doctor gets crazy. One time I did have I had paramedics in town. They came into the office with a suitcase of mine packed and said, "You're going out of town tonight." And I said, "I don't have any plans." And he said, "No, you're going out of town somewhere because you're nuts."
What were you doing that made them say that?
I don't even know what was going on then, but you just can't keep up that pace indefinitely without getting a little wacko yourself.
Now, at that time, did you have your own family or were you alone?
No, I did have a family there. I was married with one child who was very young. Did not see them very much because I was working 24 hours a day.
It really does bring up, when one reads this book, and this is what you said 30 years ago, this was the 1980s?
1980s.
Yeah.
Yep.
The question of small town medical care in general, especially in a poor state like New Mexico, what did it look like then versus now?
Well, then it was entirely different because all the health care was done by physicians. You had to be a doctor. We didn't have mid-level providers. Nowadays, I think there's good news and bad news. Physicians are not trained to practice medicine the way that's required in a small town, because you really do have to be a true generalist. And now the training is all towards specialty training. And that doesn't lend itself to practicing in small towns. The good news is, with nurse practitioners and physicians' assistants, we're able to get the health care to those areas. In fact, in Benton today, there is a large clinic. There's 5 full-time doctors, and there were 3 full-time nurse practitioners. One quit because it was too busy. But that's what's helping fill the gap. And I imagine in the future we're going to see mid-level providers do the majority of care in rural areas.
You just said what's good about that. Is there anything that patients miss when they don't have a doctor in the town?
As long as there's somebody doing healthcare, and I'll tell you, my personal experience with both physicians' assistants and nurse practitioners is that they are as competent for 98% of the things that go wrong as a physician is, and they tend to be a little more thorough because they don't have the MD-ity or D-oddity behind their name. And
Did you just say M-deity?
M-deity, yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Or if you're a D-O, a D-oddity behind your name. But so they tend to be a little more conscientious about workup, and they also tend to not have the ego issues sometimes doctors do, so they're easier to deal with. So I think it's a win-win situation.
Charles Maynard is author of the new book, Adventures of a Small Town Doctor. Charles, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And this has been our memorial program for KSFR newsman Charles Maynard, who died on the 12th of February. We will miss him very much. Thank you all for listening. Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.